In our study tonight, we want to cover just a few things, and I want you to look at the homework, I guess you would call it, on page number 4, the putting material in order. Bible chronology is very important to our study of history and geography of the Bible. And on lesson number 4, down at the bottom of that page, you see a list of things that are to be put in proper order. I'm going to trust that all of you have that done. One of the things that I do with questions such as these is use them for the purpose of review. And so let me emphasize again the correct chronology. That's very important to our study as we're going to be examining the history in verse order. Now, the first thing on our list of chronology, in this list that we have on the board, what came first? Now, I don't know hardly how to ask all of these, but you see very easily, if you have them already worked out in your lesson book, which one came first, Donna? All right, first was creation. And then what happened next? All right. What'd you say? The Tower of Babel. Okay. Did the fellow that did these mess that up? Yeah, okay, okay. Tower of Babel is number 3. There we go. All right. Well, some of you looked at that like that wasn't right. Now. Yeah, I thought we had it right up there. All right, after the Tower of Babel, what then occurred? Promises to Abraham, Genesis chapter 12. After the promises made to Abraham, then what happened? Theory? Yes, sir. Number 5. The plagues in Egypt. All right, Lynn, what happened next? The giving of the law of Moses. Then what happened, Peggy? After the law, the wandering in the wilderness. Yes, the wandering in the wilderness. Chris, what happened next? All right, very good. The conquest of Canaan. Carolyn, what's next? The period of the judges. You knew that. You've been studying that. Let's see. Who wants to go next? All right, the United Kingdom, and of course then comes Rick. Yep, number 11. All right, the divided kingdom, that's right. And after the period of the divided kingdom, we began the period of, the Assyrian captivity. All right, after the divided kingdom, we've got the beginning. And Terry, what came next?
Yep.
All right. The Babylonian captivity. And then Carolyn, what came next? The return from captivity. And then, Claire, you want to take the next one? All right, Chris? Okay, Chris? All right, the time of silence. And then, Richard, if you fumble long enough, I won't get to ask you one. 16 is the birth of Jesus. Thank you. Judy, you want to take the next one? All right, Rick. Establishment of the church, number 17. Peggy? Number 18. All right, Paul's preaching journey, 1, 2, and 3. And Donna, what chapters do we read those in? Acts chapter 2. Good. I tell you, she's good. After Paul's preaching journeys, then what came next, man? All right. Paul in prison. And then what came next? All right. Yeah, that could work. I had it written in my notes where they could be interchanged, 19 and 20. You've got Roman persecution against the church that actually existed, I think, before Paul was imprisoned, because we have the instance of the Jews employing Herod, I believe, in Acts chapter 12, to execute James and imprison Peter. No, it's not. No. Terry, go ahead. Ha! Ha! Well, I know exactly what you mean. Yeah. Of course, we're going to put number 21, the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans. And yes, I understand your position. But having examined those, I don't want a show of hands, but how did you do? Are you satisfied with what you did? If you are doing them, which I would very much encouraged to do, because if we get these events out of order, it's going to make it very difficult for us to study the history aspect. Yes, Claire? All right, that's an interesting question. When we get to the period of the kings, when the Israelites asked Samuel for a king, this was after the period of the judges, and after Samuel being the last judge, he was asked to appoint a king. He was very displeased over that, and God was very displeased over that. But God gave instructions to Samuel, give them a king. And King Saul was the first king. He was selected by God. He reigned for 40 years. He was the son of Kish. At the end of King Saul's reign, just to make it short, he killed himself to keep from being taken by the Philistines. God had rejected him from being king because of his rebellion against God, his pride and arrogancy. The next man to be king was David. He was selected because he was a man after God's own heart. That ended the lineage of Saul, his sons and grandsons and so forth, as a dynasty on the throne in Israel. Now we begin with David and his son and grandson and so forth, the reign of his family, and David reigned for 40 years. And then after David, there was David's son, Solomon. Now during that time, we've got one king for the 120 years, one king ruling over all of Israel, Saul, David, and then Solomon. But when Solomon's son, Rehoboam, became king, he made the foolish decision. When the people asked to lighten our burdens, he consulted with the younger men and as well with the older men. The older men said, if you do what they ask, they'll be faithful to you forever. He wouldn't listen to them, but he listened to the younger men. And the younger men were those who told him, you need to show them who's king. And so he increased their burdens, and they rebelled. So then we have 10 of the 12 tribes that pull off. The kingdom is divided. And they get Jeroboam, who's been down in Egypt, to become their king. And Rehoboam then continued to be king over the tribes of Judah and Benjamin. Now from that point forward, for the most part, the northern 10 tribes bore the name of Israel. The southern 2 tribes of Benjamin and Judah were known as Judah. And so you've got a dividing line between the two. And as far as our history study is concerned, that becomes a very significant point in history, because we have Israel united under one king, one at a time, Saul, David, and Solomon. And then after we are born, it's the divided kingdom. So we need to know those dates. The northern kingdom was taken captive in about 722 when the Assyrians came down and conquered their capital, Samaria. And then, of course, Jerusalem, the capital of Judah, was conquered by the Babylonians in 586. Terry, you had your hand up? Okay. All right. Here's the correct order if you didn't get those as jumbled up as they were. And the chronological order that we're going to be examining them in. Now, again, I want to emphasize this to you because it's going to be very helpful to you in your study of the history of it. Now, in our next segment that we want to begin with tonight is lesson number 2 on page 3. Page number 5 of your workbook. Page number 5 of your workbook. Okay? I'm going to put this particular slide on the first few of our lessons. I don't aim to do this every time. The material, let me explain one more time, that we're using is from a CD that was put together by Richard Bedford, and this was done in 2006, I believe. You can email Richard Bedford at the address that you see up here, or you can go on his website and find more information about this CD. I want to say that to you because you'll note that he has a copyright date on that of 2006. Now, one of the things that I'm thankful to him that he has done in the development of these PowerPoint presentations, he did not lock you into using precisely the material that he has prepared. So it gives you some flexibility, and I intend to be very flexible in the use of this material because I have some ideas of how I want to arrange the material, and we're going to see it in this lesson number 2, and you'll see it quite extensively as we get a little further down the pike. There are some passages and flags that I want to put on places and so forth that are going to be very significant. Those of you who have studied this with me before perhaps remember some of those charts. But a brief land that the Bible lands, Palestine, lesson number 2. Names for the land. This perhaps is fundamental there in your lesson book, but we want to note them. Canaan is the earliest name applied to this particular land because Canaan descended from Noah through Ham. And you can read of that genealogy in Genesis chapter 10 and Genesis chapter 10 verse 6 and verses 15 through verse 20. You have that reference in the lesson book that we're using. This term, Canaan, is used frequently throughout the Old Testament. It's beyond our purpose to list all the passages where that's found. But I do want to notice this expression because we're going to use it perhaps more frequently in our study, the promised land. And it's referred to as the promised land in our study because it was promised unto Abraham in Genesis chapter 12, beginning, and then stated again as far as the borders are concerned in Genesis chapter 15. Now, these are some passages that we're going to go over again, but I want you to write these down, make a mental note of them or something so you can remember where they're found. Genesis chapter 12 contains three promises. And I know that we've talked about this a number of times in the past, but I want you to be very, very familiar with these three promises because they constitute the scheme of redemption that's developed throughout the Bible. And these events that we're studying in history and geography are very relevant to that in the development of those. But you'll notice in verse 1, God promises to give unto Abraham a certain land. You see that stated again in verse 7. It says, "And Jehovah appeared unto Abram and said, Unto thy seed will I give this land. And there builded he an altar unto Jehovah who appeared unto him." Now that raises the question, what land? Well, we can look at the context and see where Abraham, as he was later called, was. But I want you to look in the 15th chapter because we see it very detailed where Abraham, the land that Abraham and his descendants were to receive. Now in verse 13 of chapter 15, look at your Bibles, please. Verse 13 of chapter 15. It says, "And he said unto Abraham, Know of a surety that thy seed shall be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. Also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge, and afterwards shall they come out with great substance." Let's stop for just a moment. When God says to Abraham that your descendants are going to receive this land down the pike 400 years. And when he said, they're going to serve another nation. But when they come out, they're going to come out with great substance. What is it that God is telling Abraham about? Well, I'm talking about in Genesis chapter 15, when God tells Abraham that your descendants are going to be sojourners in a land that's not theirs. And they're going to serve those people. But in 400 years, they'll come out with great substance. What is it that God is telling Abraham about? All right. All right, the Egyptians gave them anything they wanted. So the Israelites, or the descendants of Abraham, did indeed come out with great substance. They came out with all the riches that Egypt had. And if you'll pick up the reading, beginning at verse 16 of Genesis chapter 15, it says, "But thou shalt go to thy fathers in peace," I'm sorry, verse 16, "and in the fourth generation they shall come hither again, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet full. And it came to pass that when the sun went down and it was dark, behold, a smoking furnace and a flaming torch that passed between these pieces." Now look at verse 18. "In that day Jehovah made a covenant with Abram, saying, Unto thy seed have I given this land, from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenite and the Kenizzite and the Kadmonite, and the Hittite and the Perizzite and the Rephaim, and the Amorite, and the Canaanite, and the Girgashite, and the Jebusite." Now, you've seen me in times gone by, with many others, no doubt, who will draw this big circle, half circle. And we draw a circle up here, the Sea of Galilee, the Jordan River. We looked at that Sunday, I believe. Down here is the Dead Sea. Now, I didn't continue drawing our imaginary map, draw a line up here. All right? That represents the Euphrates River. One down here, just west of the Sinai Peninsula. I'm sorry, just east of the Sinai Peninsula. And you'll note the River of Egypt. And in looking at that land, this is the land that God describes unto Abraham. From the River of Egypt to the River Euphrates, the Great River, it's sometimes referred to in Scripture. And sometimes in Scripture, the Mediterranean Sea is simply called the Great Sea. And so we're going to approach it that way. But the promised land is definable from this text. We know what land that God promised unto Abraham. We also note that this particular land is referred to as the land of Israel because Abraham's descendants inherited that land. We saw that in Genesis chapter 15, as we have just mentioned. But we know that Abraham's grandson, Jacob, his name was changed to Israel. And you can read about that in Genesis 32 and in Genesis 35. I believe Genesis 32 is in our lesson book. Genesis 35 is not. But you can write that in if you would like. And we'll note that Isaac's name was, I'm sorry, Jacob. Well, Jacob's name was changed to Israel. And so when you talk about those who descended from Jacob, we talk about the 12 tribes of Israel. And this is the land then that was given unto them. All right? It's also referred to as Palestine. Now, we recognize that, as that's a common term that's used today. But that particular name, Palestine, is not used in the Bible. Now, some of you may raise an eyebrow and say, well, I believe that it is. No, it's not found at all in the American Standard Translation. The King James uses the expression Palestina. And here are some passages where you will find that. In Joel chapter 3 in verse 4, in the King James, it's spelled this way. But the term is Palestina. All right? Now, understanding that, we see what a small place that it is as far as the reference, even in Joel chapter 3. It's not used to describe the area from the Euphrates River all the way down to the river of Egypt. It's used to describe the little country of Philistia on the southern coastal plain in Joel chapter 3 and in verse 4. Now, during this period of time that we're reading about in the New Testament times and shortly thereafter, who was it that dominated this little country of Palestine, as we use that term? Well, on the board we see, and in the lesson book, it was the Romans that did that. And of course, the Israelites or the Jews, they didn't think too highly of Rome because of that. They considered themselves, as you recall, in John chapter 8 and verse 32, as Abraham's seed and always being free. And during New Testament times, they were not free. They were under the throne, or under the thumb, rather, of Rome. And then, of course, Terry, we read in history about the fall of Jerusalem in A.D. 70, where we see this term Palestine sometimes used. And I have A.D. 132, revolt, on the board. That date ought to ring a note in your mind. What was that? You remember? Pardon me? It was. It was the second Jewish revolt. And some have suggested that this fellow Hadrian desired to rebuild the temple, as it were, a monument to, I forget who. Yes. Yes, your book says 135. Yeah. Other sources say 132, 132, and then it was rebuilt in 135. Depends on what source you're looking at. Some of these dates, by the way, may vary slightly. And when we look at some of the geographic boundaries, depending upon what source you're looking at, they may vary slightly. So this is the date that I want to use for the purposes of our study. When Hadrian rebuilt the city of Jerusalem, or the temple as it were, it was counted to be a capital offense for a Jew to even be seen there. They were to be cast out. And of course the name of the country was then changed to Syria Palestina, and we know it today as Palestine. Now, all of these terms are familiar terms. When we talk about God's people during this period of history, we see the term Hebrew used. And what does that mean? So much of our material that's in the book is on the board up here. It means a stranger or a foreigner. Now, when we think of the Hebrews, Abraham was referred to as a Hebrew in Genesis chapter 14. In fact, you'll note in Hebrews chapter 11 and verses 8 through 10. I want to call your attention to that in particular. Hebrews chapter 11 verses 8 through 10, because there we often cite Abraham as an example of faith. And it tells us by faith, Abraham, when he was called, obeyed to go out into a place which he was to receive for an inheritance, and he went out not knowing whether he went. By faith, he became a sojourner in the land of promise, as in a land not his own. You see then how the term Hebrew is used. to describe those who were foreigners, as it were. And Abraham is described that way by Stephen in Acts chapter 7, a foreigner. Well, he was a foreigner. He was from Ur of Chaldee. He was dwelling among strangers, those who were Canaanites. The descendants were called of Abraham were called Hebrews while they were in Egypt. You remember in Exodus chapter 1, when Moses saw one of the Egyptian slave masters beating one of the children of Abraham, or the descendants of Abraham, in verse 13, it says, verse 13, "And he went out the second day, and behold, two men of the Hebrews were striving together. And he said unto him that did the wrong, Wherefore smitest thou thy fellow? And he said, Who made thee a prince or and a judge over us? Thinkest thou to kill me as thou killedest the Egyptian? And Moses feared and said, Surely the thing is known. Now when Pharaoh heard this saying, he sought to slay Moses," and so forth and so on. But we see in this context, that should be verses 13 and following, that the term Hebrew is used to describe these people. They were strangers, used in the New Testament to describe those who adhered to the old Jewish law and traditions. You remember, for example, in Philippians chapter 3, when the Apostle Paul is affirming the attributes that would stand out in his heritage if he was to account them as of anything. He said, a Hebrew of Hebrews. Well, what does that mean? In that text, it was a term of honor. And Paul was using it to describe himself like he was before he became a Christian. He adhered to all the Jewish laws and the traditions. Now, the term Israelite is used. Yes, ma'am. No, it's up in the Mesopotamian area south of the Euphrates River, between the Euphrates and the... I have some maps that show the ancient land and then a modern map, kind of an overlay. That'll help us on that. But that's correct. Ur of Chaldee was up in Mesopotamia. And some of our maps are going to show that. I think I may have one lined up here shortly that shows where it is. Page 42 in your lesson book. Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes, they are. They're used that way to describe those who developed from Abraham. Yeah. We're going to look at that in, I think, the next point or two to see that that's the case. Now, these Israelites, you'll note, preferred to think of themselves as Israelites, because of the stock that they placed in being of the descent of Abraham. Now, we studied in the book of Romans, in the 9th through the 11th chapters, the use of the term Israel or Israelite in reference to the conflict that existed between the Jews and the Gentiles. As we started the book of Romans, you remember in Romans chapter 1, verses 16 and 17, Paul said, "I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first and also to the Greek." And that becomes the theme of the book, to show that the gospel will save both. But the Jew had an arrogant disposition and thought that he was ahead of the Gentile, and that just wasn't true. You see, he wasn't honored simply because he was a Jew. When you turn to the 9th chapter of the book of Romans and begin at verse 6, Paul makes a very simple point. For they are not all Israel that are of Israel. Now, that wording is particularly interesting to me. Today, God's Jew is not one who descended from the fleshly lineage of Abraham. Israel today is not those who descended from Jacob. Israel today is the church. The Israel of God today is the church. And that's why Paul says in Romans 9, verse 6, they are not all Israel that are of Israel. You see, those who make up the Israel of God today are those who are from Jewish background and they are from Gentile background. In fact, in the Galatian letter, in the 6th chapter, I believe it is, in verse 16, it says, as many as shall walk by this rule, peace be upon them, and mercy, and upon the Israel of God. You see, Paul's not just pronouncing blessing upon the nation of Israel, but he's speaking concerning the church. The church is the Israel of God. Now you see why then that the Jew preferred to use the term Israelite. That gave him some special significance, but not today. Yes, sir. Yeah. Right. Well, that's right. That's right. And that's how Paul speaks regarding the subject of circumcision that was used to identify these who descended from Abraham. It was a covenant that God made with them. But in Romans chapter 2, he identifies in verse 28, for he is not a Jew who is one outwardly, neither is that circumcision which is outward in the flesh, but he is a Jew who is one inwardly, and circumcision is that of the heart and the spirit, not in the letter, whose praise is not of men, but of God. Now we might raise the question, who constitutes the Israel of God today? Well, that's the church. Who is God's Jew today? Well, that's the fellow who's a member of the church. And that's the point that we want to see. This term, Jew, was first used to apply to those living in the southern kingdom, the kingdom of Judah, and it was used actually late in Old Testament history. You'll see that used in 2 Kings chapter 16. I'm not going to take the time at this point to locate that in the chronology of the kings, but just to simply at this point make that note. We'll come back in our chronological study and our maps and, of course, look at some of these things as well. Any Israelite in captivity was known as a Jew. We see this term used many, many times during the period of the restoration of Israel to the promised land, or the land of Palestine, or the land of Canaan, as sometimes we refer to it. And in fact, in the book of Esther that I preached on Sunday night, the term Jew is used 63 times. From this period of restoration, Ezra through Esther is used some 63 times. Yes?
As ironic and funny as it sounds, the scriptures actually teach that a real Jew is a Christian.
Oh, yeah.
On the surface, that sounds like a funny, ironic, kind of bizarre statement, but that's really what the scriptures
teach. Yes. Yes, Romans chapter 2 is very emphatic about that. Yeah, God's Jew today is the fellow who is the Christian. Yes.
Did you say Jew was found somewhere before the book of Esther?
From Ezra through Esther. It's used 63 times in that connection. Well, do a word search on Jew and begin with this period of restoration from Ezra through Esther, and you should come up with 63 times it's located.
Well, 33 in terms of Esther 2.
Really? Well, I'll have to go back and look at that. I may have a wrong number then.
Am I understanding the terms correctly that the words Hebrew and Jew are referring to the same person? However, the word Hebrew emphasizes physical lineage, but the word Jew represents religious conviction?
Well, I don't think I made that distinction, no. I said that the term Jew was used to identify those in the southern kingdom originally, those who were of Judah. But it later came to identify those who were Israelites. Well, it's just the definition of the word. Hebrew means stranger. And the term Jew was kind of a shortened version of Judah. Oh, okay. 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 So you were saying, remind me, that the term Hebrew compared to Jew is used how? Well, yes, an ethnic group. Yeah. Yeah, it encompasses that, but yeah, I have no problem with expressing it that way. Yeah. Well, yeah, Hebrew was a language that was spoken by the Jews, but the term Hebrew simply means a sojourner, and it's used to identify individuals, not just to identify the language. Yes, Richard.
Okay. I tried to first out Jew, and I only got the singular, I only got the 33.
Jews.
But
plural.
Jews, yes, yeah. I find the first reference in 2 Kings 16:6.
Yeah.
And in the Old Testament, the whole Old Testament, there's 81 matches.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's actually 255 in the entire Bible.
Well, yes. But this period of the restoration, I found it fascinating how many times it's used in that period of time. We see it kind of scattered about outside of that, but it's concentrated during this period of the restoration. And I think from Ezra to Esther, check that. I believe the number is 63. I may be mistaken. All right? The point is it's used a whole lot during the time of the restoration. All right? Okay? Now, Palestine, very small country. Less than one-fourth the size of the state of Alabama. Now, you might wonder why the state of Alabama is used. Bob and Sandra Waldron, as I understand, are from the state of Alabama. Yes, the author of our book.
When you say Palestine now, you're talking about Israel, not the land of Philistines.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I said we were going to use this term in all four of these, in fact, in that way. Yes. No. 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 Well, not modern day necessarily, but I believe if memory serves me correct, it's the coastal plain, the hill country, the Jordan Valley, and then the piece of land on the Transjordan side before you get into the Arabian Desert. It's very small in comparison. Okay? Any other question or comment? That's a good question. All right. The territory of Palestine is about 12,000 square miles. Now we think, oh, what a big place. The state of Alabama has 51,000 plus. The state of California has 163 plus square miles. Rarely did the Israelites control all of the area that was given to them. And Chris, this hits at the home of the question that you asked. Comment? Question?
Long Pine,
Yeah. Well, you figured about 150 miles, and you've got it. Yeah. That's about it. I've got some maps I want to show you where Palestine is just laid into the various states of the United States, different ones, and I think you'll be impressed with just how small a country this is. But, Chris, I think it's significant when we consider just how small it is that Israel did not control it most of their history. John? Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? Yeah, that is interesting. In 2 Samuel chapter 8, Chris, look at verse 3. 2 Samuel chapter 8, verse 3. Would you read that for me, please? Yes, verse 3. Hadadezer. What river? The Euphrates River, yes. Now, if David went to recover his dominion at the river, what does that necessarily conclude, Lynn? They didn't have control of it. They had, but they had lost it, and now he's recovering it. Had a discussion with a denominational preacher about whether or not the extent of the land that was promised to Abraham ever possessed by all of the Israelites. And he said, no. And I read this passage, how that David went to recover his dominion at the river Euphrates. And he inadvertently said, how can you recover something you never had? I said, that's right. Now you got it. You can't. Now, Solomon, go ahead. Carolyn and then Terry, please. Well, that's what got David in trouble. It was time for battle, and he was on his rooftop looking at Bathsheba. But anyway, our point here being that they didn't control all of it, and they had to go and recover some. You'll note in 1 Kings chapter 4, in verse 21, it tells us that Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the river. What river is that? The river Euphrates, unto the land of the Philistines and unto the border of Egypt. And they brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. Now, Solomon had people all around the Mediterranean Sea paying taxes to him. We won't talk about that tonight, but what we want to see is this was a small, tiny little piece of real estate that they didn't themselves control all of the time. Now, as we talk about the size of it, let's put it on some maps that you're familiar with, Palestine and Alabama. Does that tell you just how big it was? It fits into just the northern tip of Alabama. Palestine, as we mentioned, 12,000 square miles. Alabama, 51 plus. Birmingham, north, is divided into 16 counties. Palestine is divided into 12 tribes. Gives you an idea of the size of it. Think about Indiana. Any of you know of the approximate size of Indiana, having lived there or something to that effect? It's about 36,000 square miles. Richard knows about that. And you see how that Palestine is very small. New Mexico, Richard, you know about New Mexico. And here's Palestine fitting into New Mexico. Yes. All right. Okay. All right. So you've got one city. Of course, we've got to consider that Palestine, the Jews or Israelites, they weren't quite as concentrated as you would find them in Los Angeles and such things. But at any rate, here's Palestine in Texas. That ought to ring a an illustration to some of you. Now, Richard was talking about this map and its proportions. I want you to look at the bottom of this map. I didn't have one that just was specific about the state of California, but this one came from the Israel Security website, putting Israel into the state of California. Now, I don't know if proportionally you would agree with that or not. It might be significantly smaller than that, but when we compare square miles, we can't miss it with that. Again, we're looking at Palestine, about 12,000 square miles, and California is 163, almost 164 square, 1,000 square miles. California considerably bigger than this whole country was. Now, if you put that in the United States, in the ones that we've seen where they were proportionate, this one is not, but where they are proportionate, you see how small Palestine is in relation to some of these states. Now again, a tiny country. We want to see just how tiny. When we read of King Jeroboam setting up a golden calf in Dan and one in Bethel to try to keep the Israelites from going to the city of Jerusalem in order that they might worship. From Dan to Bethel. Here's Dan up here in the northern portion. And from Beersheba down here to Dan is 150 miles. That's not very far. Terry, as you were talking about it, you can define that on the eastern side of the Sierras. It's not all that far. All right, that's pretty close. When you look at the northern portion, of course, it expands wider in the southern portion. We're looking at about 30 miles from the Mediterranean Sea over to the Jordan River. And then from the Dead Sea over, we're looking at approximately 50 miles. So it's not a great big place. Not a great big place, and we're out of town. Out of time, right? That's bad. That's bad. Okay. Well, we'll stop with that. Pardon me? Define it. Oh. Well, I think I've got my line a little short here, but you'll find it on your map. Should be right over in this area. Yeah. Gaza to the Dead Sea. We're going to be talking about some of the terrain, so be sure you study through the rest of this lesson, and we'll pick up on some of that Sunday morning.